You may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Monica Monday. My co-counsel is Dustin Dean, and together we represent Virginia Fuel and the James C. Justice Company. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
This is a breach of contract appeal concerning a mining contract, and there were basically three issues before the trial court. The first was Lambert's breach of contract claim, and that issue presented was whether we had breached the contract when we discontinued paying royalty payments after discovering there was not enough coal to mine. The second issue was our breach of contract counterclaim. And that question asked whether the plaintiff, Lambert, breached the contract because there was not enough coal to mine under the leases. The leases had represented that there was 1.5 million tons of coal, and the summary judgment record reflects that there was 811,000. Finally, there was our recoupment and credit affirmative defenses. And these asked whether we were entitled to recover the value of the coal that could not be mined under the leases. Resolution of all three of these issues turned on two important provisions of the contract. The royalty provision, which stated that the purchase price would be paid as a royalty for coal mined, and also a coal tonnage reference in Exhibit A of the agreement. However, the trial court did not expressly address either of these two provisions. It interpreted the contract in a way that read out both of these provisions from the contract, and it also granted summary judgment on a record that showed that there were triable issues of fact about how much coal there was to mine. Now, the two issues that are at the heart of this case, I'd like to start there with the analysis. When these provisions are read individually, together, and with the contract as a whole, they reflect that the parties contemplated that the payment price was going to be a royalty for coal mined under the agreement. That's what the agreement says. However, we also have argued on brief that there may be two reasonable interpretations for these provisions, and therefore they are probably ambiguous. So let's start with the royalty provision, the coal mined. The royalty provision is in paragraph 4. Two times in that provision, it references coal mined. This is the heart of the party's agreement. The contract requires that the purchase price be a royalty for coal mined under the leases, payable monthly at a rate of $2 per ton mined with a minimum royalty of $40,000. Now, a royalty is basically a term of art. It is a payment for the privilege of removing a mineral from the ground. It is a payment that is made for the use of a right, and it is based upon the quantity of the mineral produced.
Let me ask you a question, if I may.
Yes, Your Honor.
What would happen if, instead of there not being enough coal, there was way more coal than anybody anticipated, and the royalties ended up being a whole lot more than $2.3 million? Is that a cap then on how much you have to pay?
Your Honor, the contract may be a little bit ambiguous on this point. The contract doesn't address the situation of is there too much, is there too little, what happens when you reach the purchase price. I believe that that would require some evidence to determine, and there are, in fact, a lot of missing provisions in this contract.
Well, that brings me to my second question, which is paragraph 7. It says that as soon as possible after signing this letter of intent, the party shall negotiate the assignment and assumption agreements, which shall contain customary provisions, conditions, representations, warranties, and terms that are mutually agreeable to the parties. Did they ever do that?
I don't know whether they did, but I can tell you, Your Honor, it is not part of the record, nor are the leases part of the record. There's also a provision here that talks about, starting if they want to start mining coal right away and there's a separate agreement. That's not part of the record here.
Well, of course, one of the big issues is whether Exhibit A is a warranty and a representation as to how much coal there is there. It seems to me that this assignment and assumption agreement is where you'd get into all those reps and warranties if they were made.
There may be, Your Honor, but we can't decide on this record. And I think that's another reason why it was inappropriate for the trial judge to grant summary judgment on the breach of contract claim and on our affirmative defenses, and also granting a demur on our breach of contract claim. I think we had clearly stated a claim for breach of contract, and that particular claim does arise more to the point out of Exhibit A. The court, in dismissing the breach of contract counterclaim, basically made two findings. One was that it sounded in tort, not contract, and second, that the contract only required Lambert to convey the mining permit and the leases. And
can I interrupt you there?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Based on your last answer, if the 2.5 is not a purchase price that the buyer is expected to pay, at least, and the seller can expect no more than, doesn't that change the whole character of the transaction?
It does not, Your Honor. And we acknowledge there are ambiguities in the contract. For example, there is a $2.5 million purchase price, $2.3 million of which was to be paid as a royalty for coal mine.
But that seems odd to me as well. They're selling leases and a permit. They're not really selling coal, technically.
That's true, Your Honor, although the parties did in Exhibit A represent the amount of coal that was under the leases, and Lambert agrees. It is agreed at least five places in its brief that is a representation about the amount of coal.
I guess what I'm getting at is there is obviously tension in this contractual transaction, and there are broad statements like, here's the purchase price, here's what you agree to pay, here's what I agree to accept. And then there's ways of paying it. And the question appears to be, and correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, how high do we elevate that method of payment in terms of the transactional understanding?
Right, and there isn't much to this agreement, and the payment provision is what the parties elected, and it was a payment as a royalty for coal mine. So while there are ambiguities in the agreement, and we agree with that, you know, it's a $2.5 million purchase price, but the payment is for coal mine. There's no provision in the contract that requires Virginia Fuel to mine. There's no provision in the contract that says how many monthly payments you're supposed to make.
Let me stop you there if I can. There's no agreement, there's no obligation of Virginia Fuel to actually mine, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. No express provision.
So, and you say that even the minimum payments would be paid out of the royalties. So if they don't mine, they pay nothing under this agreement. Isn't that a nonsensical result?
It is not, Your Honor. It appears that the parties, and maybe we need evidence on this, but what I would say is that it appears from all the language in the agreement and the way that it was written was, we're going to allow Virginia Fuel to decide when it's going to mine. But if it's mining, it's got to pay the $40,000 minimum royalty.
But if it is mining or if it's not?
If it is mining, because it has to be from coal mined. That minimum royalty payment provision is tied to that for the coal mined.
Why isn't the dollar amount tied to the coal mined, and the $40,000 is whether you mine coal or not, you pay us $40,000 per month?
Well, and Your Honor, if it said that, I would agree, and it doesn't. That's really what we need to have in order to reach the reading that Lambert wants, is to say the minimum royalty is $40,000 whether you mine or not. And it's interesting to look at...
Why would Lambert ever enter into this agreement? Their property is tied up indefinitely. They don't have to... Virginia Fuel doesn't have to mine, doesn't have to pay them anything. There's no end date.
And that was what the parties elected, Your Honor. But again, it appears that they were going to leave with Virginia Fuel the decision about when to mine. They also, Your Honor, in the security agreement...
And whether to mine.
And
it didn't matter to them because they were getting $40,000 a month, whether they mined, whether they didn't mine, whether they mined up to the bottom, the ceiling?
We disagree, Your Honor. That minimum royalty provision is tied to the royalty language for coal mine, and it doesn't say, if it said, and you owe a minimum monthly royalty of $40,000 whether you mine or not, then we wouldn't even be here. But, for example, look at
the minimum monthly royalty of $40,000, not tied to coal mine, there's a comma, with a minimum monthly royalty of $40,000.
Doesn't minimum mean whether you do it or not? That's the whole idea of minimum.
It does not, Your Honor. And in fact, I would point the court to the case of Holmes Smokeless versus Combs, which we cited in our brief. And in that case, it was a mining lease that had a minimum royalty of $1,000 per year. And it said, as long as the lessee continues to mine coal from the leased premises, whether it mines enough coal to produce that amount at the tonnage royalty or not. We don't have that language. We don't have that clarification. And also we know
It seems like to me that you would be in better shape if you did have it. But go ahead.
There's a case of National Coal Company, which seems very similar to this case. And as I understand it, the bottom line is that these are terms of art in the industry. And so where you have a contract with reference to mineral that's known to exist, where the quantity is not necessarily known, and I know you would take issue with that, but if we take the position that the quantity isn't known and really can't be known, then with language like this, it seems to me that this case says that this means, the royalty means that it is a flat payment every month to satisfy this sales contract, whether you mine the coal or not. Tell me why that National Coal does not.
Sure, Your Honor, and I think it's based upon this unique transaction. I would point the court to the guarantee, which is a related document in this transaction, at Joint Appendix 16, which states that the credit extended is to be repaid by the mining of coal under the permit. We also have the security agreement at page 11 and 12 of the Joint Appendix, which ties the timing of the payment to when the coal is mined. And it states, the payment is delinquent if not received before the first day of the month following the month in which the mineral is mined for purposes of computing the royalty. This whole agreement contemplates that the royalty is for coal mined.
But why defend the most implausible reading of this? Your only point, as I understand it, on appeal is that there should be a trial to figure out these answers.
And that's the other argument, Your Honor, is that there does appear to be an ambiguity because we have a purchase price, we have a royalty to be paid from coal mined, and it's unclear what happens when you're not mining or when there's not enough coal to mine. And on this summary judgment record, I believe that we were entitled to a trial to determine these facts.
What would the trial be about? When you reproduce these documents, they're not going to get any better. Are you just going to get into what the intentions of the parties were?
Yes, Your Honor.
Industry standards?
Yes, because if the contract is ambiguous, then the court is entitled to receive that evidence to determine the meaning of the contract. And I think particularly...
But if you all took the position before the trial court, Judge, this document is not ambiguous. We say it means this, they say it means that. The court looked at it and said it's not ambiguous, it means that. So everyone has presented this to the trial court as it's not ambiguous.
Your Honor, we did argue below that the court should receive extrinsic evidence to determine the meaning of the agreement. We did argue that below, so that argument was presented. And it is the duty of the trial court to construe that contract. I would also point out that regardless of any of this, the recoupment defense is independent of all of these issues. Recoupment under 8.01.422 provides that a defendant may plead any equitable defense to a contract action. We provided evidence through the summary judgment record that there was only 811,000 tons of coal when the contract represented that there wasn't. A trier of fact could find that we were entitled to a credit for what we could not mine. So if the agreement was you're going to pay a royalty from coal mined, but there wasn't enough, we believe that that was sufficient to create an issue of fact for a jury.
You had wanted to save some time.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have a minute and 20 seconds left.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Scott of Buchanan County Bar, and I represent Lambert Coal, the appellee in this appeal. If it pleases the court, we respectfully suggest there are five reasons why Lambert should prevail on summary judgment in this field. The first is that the transactional documents are clear and unambiguous. As one of Your Honor's questioned counsel, BFC did take the position in the trial court that the document was clear and unambiguous. As a matter of fact, in its opening brief in this case, before this court, it contended that the contract was clear and unambiguous and should be construed in accordance with the argument just made by VFC. Then it retreated from that position in its responsive brief and says it's probably ambiguous. We suggest the contract is not ambiguous based on interpretation of the transactional documents in this case.
But didn't they argue in the alternative below that it's unambiguous, I win? You came in, no, it's unambiguous, and I win. And didn't they make the position, well, if it's never unambiguous, they win. In the alternative, if you're thinking that way, it's at least ambiguous, we should have a trial. Are you saying it was unpreserved in terms of procedural?
I am not. I am not suggesting that. I'm sorry.
So is that issue now on the table, whether or not this document is ambiguous for purposes?
Absolutely. That issue is on the table. If the document can be interpreted in two ways, it may be ambiguous. And if Your Honor will indulge me just for a moment, that doesn't mean that we don't win, and I'll explain why. Insofar as the purchase agreement is concerned, the asset clause specifically says that what is being sold here is the assignment of two coal leases that are set out in Exhibit A and also a mining permit. And when we turn to Exhibit A, please note that there is prefatory language in Exhibit A. The document itself is titled General Terms of Sale to Virginia Fuel Corporation. And the first unnumbered paragraph in Exhibit A says Lambert Coal will enter into an agreement to transfer certain of its assets under the following terms. And there are three numbered paragraphs. It lists the purchase price, $2.5 million. It lists and re-identifies the mining permit at issue here. And then lastly, it refers to the two issues. And one of Your Honors asked counsel a question a moment ago about additional transactional documents. They're not part of the record. But in defending summary judgment, when Lambert moved for summary judgment on May 27, certainly VFC could have made those documents part of the record if they bore on this issue. But they did. Exhibit A.
Do you know factually whether they were ever entered into or not?
I do not. And unfortunately, neither appellate counsel represented the parties on, or at least Ms. Mundy and I didn't represent parties below. But anyway.
I would say that might be fortunate rather than unfortunate.
Perhaps so.
May I interrupt you again?
Yes, sir.
Do you have to, when you're at summary judgment and the argument is the ambiguity or the clarity of a contractual document, do you have to proffer your parole extrinsic evidence, or is the only thing you have to do if you're fighting the contrary interpretation is say, no, it is ambiguous, and that's why we have a trial?
Your Honor, as I read this court's rules in a circuit court opinion, because I couldn't find an opinion from this court on point, it seems to me, or it seems to Lambert Cole in this case, that once a motion for summary judgment is filed and there's an act that uses VFC's discovery responses in support of summary judgment, that even though this court's rules prohibit the use of discovery depositions, which were not taken in this case, in support of a motion for summary judgment, this court's rules do not prohibit interrogatory responses, affidavits, and the circuit court so noted, right or wrong, nor depositions had they been taken to defend a motion for summary judgment. So in my response would be yes, that would be appropriate for VFC to have done in this case.
So under that theory, the court could resolve an ambiguous contract at summary judgment if the information presented to the court that's not involving depositions or affidavits eliminates any possible...
Absolutely, and it's the circuit court case cited in our decision, in our brief, Realstar, so noted. At some point, Tom, and bear in mind that VFC or the burden of proof on its affirmative defenses and a breach of contract counterclaim, at some point in time, they have an obligation to come forward and engage in self-help to not only support their claims, but to defend the claim of Lambert Cole for summary judgment. But I hope that answered your question. But if I may return to the contract documents, because the importance of their interpretation is at the crux of this case. Paragraph 3 does say that it refers to one lease with two abbreviations, the LL and HFL lease. Royalty together is from 8-10% of 1.1 million tons. It refers to the second lease, the Alpha lease, at 8% of approximately 400,000 tons. Now, I suggest to you that the only reading, because just because the parties disagree on the meaning of contract terms does not mean that the terms are ambiguous. And if one party's reading is forestrained or contrary to reason, then there's not any ambiguity, and that's precisely the situation here. What that means is that Lambert sold two leases and a mining permit that were set out in Exhibit A. All the parties contemplated was to identify those two leases and the mining permit in Exhibit A. The mineral owners, obviously, from paragraph 3 are LL and HFL and Alpha, which were also the original lessors that leased, that engaged in the leases with Lambert Coal, which is a different entity, the seller in this case. And so what it was a heads up, an identification of the lease, that look, VSC, you've got to pay 8-10% of some figure to the original lessors and the owners as a royalty to them. It can't be the royalty referred to in the purchase agreement because that's predicated on a totally different calculus of $2 per ton, the greater of $2 per ton or $40,000 minimum monthly royalty. Secondly, there's absolutely no promise whatsoever of any mineable and marketable tons of coal in place in Exhibit A or otherwise. The only promise that is found in this agreement is in the permit and the leases, and that promise is that the leases and the permit are validly issued and existing in good standing. There aren't any outstanding violations. There are no modifications or written violations at all. The payment clause, on the other hand, indicates $2 per ton with a minimum with a $40,000 minimum monthly royalty. That is not ambiguous at all. As your honors have noted, it means that each and every month, whether coal is mined, and there is absolutely no requirement whatsoever in any of these contractual documents that VSC has to mine an ounce of coal. And in the absence of having to mine an ounce of coal, then the $40,000 is payable regardless. It's a minimum payment. Your Honor, this is a purchase agreement. It is not a lease, regardless of any terms to the contrary when you read it in context.
Counsel, I understand your argument with regard to paragraph 4. It seems to me that perhaps counsel's point that that's called into question, your interpretation of it, when we get to page 4, where we talk about when the payments will be made. And the paragraph references on the 15th of the month following the month in which the mineral is mined, almost as if you are tying this payment to the mining of coal. Also, on your guarantee of payment and performance to be repaid by the mining of coal. So even if I agree with you with regard to 4, tell me why those two paragraphs don't support opposing counsel's argument that this is tied to coal mine.
Your Honor, an opposing counsel does make that argument, and that argument is, and I'll explain why, is forestrained and contrary to reason, because there is a calculus to determine the payment. The payment is $40,000. Lambert could care less whether or not they mined any coal. There is a ceiling payment if VSC did mine coal to the extent it exceeded $40,000, it was $2 per ton. So in accordance with the provision that Your Honor just referred to, the only way to determine whether the minimum monthly payment was due or a greater ceiling payment was due is to wait until the 30th day of the preceding month, make the payment due on the 15th of the following month, see whether or not there were more than 20,000 tons of coal mined at $2 a ton equals $40,000. If there was, the ceiling payment was due. If not, the $40,000 payment was due. That is the only logical, reasonable interpretation of this contract. And I'd like to go back to a question that Madam Justice asked earlier this morning. The 1.1 million tons of coal and 400,000 tons of coal is not a promise. It's identification of the lease, and it's at best an expression of opinion under the Saxby and D. Garnett cases, which admittedly are fraud cases, but they were still based on contracts. The principles are the same. But let's assume hypothetically that when the parties entered into this agreement, it turned out that there were 10 million tons of coal on that property, not 1.5 million tons. At $2 a ton, the extra would be 8.5 million tons. Certainly, Lambert would not be due an additional $17 million at $2 a ton because the deal was $2.5 million, $200,000 for the permit, and the balance of the purchase price, $2.3 million. By the same token, same deal, parties enter into the same arrangement. Turns out there's 10 tons on the property. Certainly, Lambert wouldn't just be due $20 at $2 a ton, because the deal was Lambert was entitled to $2.3 million, the balance of the purchase price. So that's what the arrangement is here. It's not tied to mining coal. It's not predicated upon tonnages or anything. It was an absolute sale. And I'm certainly not trying to be flippant, but we can stick a horse in the corner and call it a pig, but it's still a horse. And this is an out-and-out sale purchase agreement. Plain and simple. There's nothing in the
What I know about coal leases would fit into a thimble, but it seems to me that the forfeiture, the default provisions here support your argument, that if this were a lease, you know, upon default, it would just be a forfeiture, as opposed to here there's an acceleration of the unpaid purchase price.
Well, I suggest that they do support our argument in this case, because we could mine for the very, VSC could mine the very first month, fail to make that minimum payment on the 15th, I think it would be August, because the deal was closed in July, the agreements are dated in June, and not pay the purchase price, then according to the acceleration clause, the entire debt would be due and payable.
Your Honor, I only have about 2.5 minutes left, and the second reason that we should prevail, as I already mentioned, and I won't go into it too much further, is that there's absolutely no duty to mine any coal. And these are terms of art, as this court has suggested. Minimum monthly royalty means an unconditional covenant or guarantee of payment, regardless of the circumstances or conditions encountered, the economic feasibility, about continued mining. Keep in mind, there's a difference between mineable and marketable coal and tonnage in place. There may be tonnage in place of 1 million tons. 500,000 tons might be mineable and marketable. Today, 5 years from now, coal prices go up to $500 a ton. What's not mineable and marketable today may be mineable and marketable then or 5 years earlier. The point is that the lessee in these circumstances, or in this case, VFC, the buyer, they assume the risk, and that's borne out by the case law, because mining is not an exact science. And then finally, let me conclude, and this deals with both our third and our fourth argument. And with regard to this court's right result, wrong reason jurisprudence, there is evidence in the record to suggest that there was no consideration here for the promise, because consideration has to be not only a detriment to the promisee, but it has to be induced by the promise. Now, it wouldn't couch in the record before the trial court as a consideration argument. It was couched as a material term argument. But the bottom line is, on page 192, for example, of the record, VFC specifically argued in the trial court that you induced us to enter into this contract by a promise of 1.5 million tons, when there was no promise whatsoever. Finally, let me leave the court with this. Your Honors also know that VFC undertook its own investigation. I mean, before this transaction was ever sealed, before it was ever inked, VFC told Lambert, we think you're not, Lambert furnished an engineering report, we think your figures are exaggerated. We can't mine a lot of this coal. They undertook their own investigation, and as a consequence, they still entered in the deal. They didn't rely on it. Thank you very much. I see that my time is up, and I appreciate the opportunity to practice before this court.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
May it please the court. This court's case law states that when the sole consideration for this type of a mining contract is a royalty, there is an implied duty to mine. That is the Home Smokeless versus Combs case. We cited it in our reply brief. It is at 204 Virginia 561. That is the general rule, that if there's no provision, there's an implied duty to mine, but it is judged by a standard of reasonableness. You can't decide that on summary judgment on this record. The evidence, the only evidence in the summary judgment record is our evidence that shows that there was about half the amount of coal that was stated in the contract, and we couldn't pay the royalties for coal mined if it wasn't.
Was there any proffer to the trial court of other extrinsic evidence that would be relevant and admissible at a later trial?
There was not, Your Honor, and I don't think we were under a duty to do that because the court said that the contract was plain and unambiguous, so it didn't even reach the issue of ambiguity. Even then, I would say that the summary judgment record was our evidence that showed in an undisputed fashion that there was only 811,000 tons of coal. That was not contradicted. I believe that that is sufficient to show that that was a material term of the agreement and that the amount of coal was critical to the payment provision in the contract.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.